WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writer's Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We just had the primary election for the mayor of New York City, and the winner, the very likely next mayor, is Democrat Eric Adams. He's the borough president of Brooklyn and a former state senator. But most importantly in this race, Adams was, for more than two decades, a police officer. And perhaps no debate in our society is more divisive than questions about policing. And here Adams holds a truly unique position. In his youth, he was beaten by police. When he joined the NYPD himself, he was a firebrand and an advocate for black officers. But now he's a sympathetic figure to the police department, a kind of law and order candidate. He rebuked other candidates who spoke of severely cutting police budgets, and he made the national spike in violent crime a big part of his rhetoric. Assuming that Eric Adams wins the general election, which is overwhelmingly likely, he'll take over a city that faces multiple overlapping crises that might daunt any politician. Mr. Adams, you there?
Yes, I am.
There you are.
What you do is you go to the voice memo, you turn it on, you start a voice memo and start recording, and just hold the phone up to your ear as if we're talking on the phone.
Yep, now I'm recording. Now, am I, through the interview, am I holding it up like this?
Like we're on a phone call.
All right, that sucks.
Well, you know, life is hard.
And then you get elected mayor.
No, exactly. You're the one that wanted to have the second hardest office in the whole country. My you can get out of it now if you want. I know one woman who'd be pleased. Now, it seems very recently where New York politics was being talked about as the center of, you know, the ascent of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the left in general. Along comes you, Eric Adams, and you're being celebrated on the day we speak in the most conservative column in the New York Times by Bret Stephens as something of a savior and a repudiation of the left. Do you see your likely ascent to Gracie Mansion and to City Hall as a repudiation of the left in New York City?
No, I don't. And I think one of the greatest tragedies of this campaign was the removal of my left philosophy. I am a progressive, and the 35 plus years of history shows that, you know, as a sergeant marching in front of Rockefeller Plaza, only to go to Albany to reverse the draconian Rockefeller drug laws, marriage equality, my conference to get that vote on the floor 1 year to see who were not voting for it, and then later to push it through, gun violence. I testified in federal court. The judge mentioned me in her ruling on why she ruled against the police department. And so I believe that I am not a repudiation of the left. I believe I am the energy and spirit of New Yorkers. Darn it, they just want the lights to be on. They want their garbage picked up. They don't want their children not being educated. They're paying their taxes, and we should be doing our job with their tax dollars. And they heard me.
I was confused during the campaign, and I never really got a straight answer that I could glean and help me on this. All you say is true. And at the same time, you switched parties. You became a Republican for quite a long time. Why was that?
Yes, and it was out of real anger of the Democratic Party. You know, sometimes we view life based on our current state, but we need to go back. We were dealing with a city where we had 2,000 homicides a year. We saw a Democratic Party that created many of the draconian laws that were put in place. We were incarcerating a large number of people for small amounts of crack cocaine instead of giving them the help they deserve. We had the crime bill that devastated many of our communities. And then we saw the Democratic Party in charge, but not dealing with real crime. And I was seeing that crime every day. And it was my protest of just saying I'm tired of this party ignoring the plight of people in the inner cities. And that was my protest and reflection. I could have done it a different ways. But, you know, as you move through life, you learn from your lessons. You don't relive them.
Are you saying you regret becoming a Republican for a period of time?
Yes, I do. There was no reason to do so. I could have found a better way to voice my outrage with the party. I could have resigned from the department and ran for office. And there were other things I could have done. But, you know, I made a lot of mistakes in life. Let me tell you something. I am perfectly imperfect. You know, I've made so many darn mistakes in my life that you have to laugh and say, how did this guy still get here? But I never stopped. I never stopped grinding, and I never stopped learning from those errors.
But you seem very plain-spoken and straightforward. What are your biggest mistakes?
Well, number one, I should have married my childhood sweetheart. She kicked me to the curb and went to Washington to marry someone else, you know. So, there are a lot of things that I did wrong. I wish I would have spent more time with my son. That was a real impactful moment for me. I spent so much time saving the lives of children that I was really afraid I was going to lose my son. And I'm just really amazed at how much he has developed as a child. And he said to me after the Eric Garner incident some years ago that, Dad, I understand why you were so determined. And our relationship is an amazing relationship, even when he was a child. But I wish I would have been around him more. And I put the movement in front of being the dad that I should have been during that time, in my opinion.
New Yorkers are beat. They're exhausted. This pandemic has been so brutal in the worst way. There's been lockdowns, death, curfews, changing mask rules, dealing with remote education for kids, no access to the arts. The list goes on and on and on. And you might soon be the leader whose job it is to restore New York to normal. What are you going to do? For example, you have 25% of New Yorkers who are still vaccine hesitant. One-third of hospital workers reportedly have not gotten their shots. One-third of hospital workers in New York. Why hasn't Mayor de Blasio tried to get that vaccination rate up? What mistakes has he made, and what are you going to do?
Well, you said something. You said two things that's very important. Number one, you said, how are we going to get back to normal? And there's a book called New York, New York, New York that I'm reading. And a woman went to Mayor Koch and she said, Mr. Mayor, can you make the city work again? And Mayor Koch looked at her and said, ma'am, this city never worked. And that's the reality. We call it normal. You know, you and I, we probably went to our great restaurants. We probably lived a great life. But it wasn't normal. Has never been normal.
That's not very reassuring what you're telling me.
But it's being honest. We need to you know, be very honest that our city is dysfunctional, and it always has been for a large number of New Yorkers. You and I, we're insulated from that dysfunctionality. But, you know, let's be clear. I could take you throughout this city where the conditions have remained the same continuously throughout mayors after mayors. And so what I must do is stop the dysfunctionality of a city that has normalized being dysfunctional. And that is part of our inability to get the vaccination program the way it ought to be, to deal with the failure of testing. I told the mayor from the beginning of this COVID process that we should have opened the command center down at the foot of the Brooklyn Bridge, that we should have built out a system using real-time governance where we can see exactly where the testings were taking place, where we were actually seeing the hot spots so we could deploy things in real time. We must move our city to a real time. That's what we need to do with the vaccine. Every day we could easily use a simple Google Doc. When a person comes in, get vaccinated, put the information in Google Doc, do a nightly mapping to look at the areas in real time that we're not reaching herd immunity and deploy the resources there and use all of our agencies in the process.
Will you tell hospital workers that they must be vaccinated?
No, I would not do that.
Why not?
What I will say to them...
Why wouldn't you do that?
First, let me tell you what I will do, and then we'll circle back to why I wouldn't do that. What I would tell them is that either you get vaccinated, and I'm going to strongly encourage that, or you have to get tested daily as you go into the hospital so we can know your status. I'm going to encourage vaccination. I am vaccinated, and I'm going to encourage that. There, when I sit down in the groups of people that I have met with, there are real fears that people have. We're going to evolve to the place where COVID is going to be our norm. Let's be clear. COVID is a formidable opponent. It's going to be here a while. But there are real fears that people have because of the method on how we develop the vaccine. And there are real fears. And we need to get people off those fears and talk them off the cliff. We need to really use credible messengers to get people to embrace this and not feel as though we're doing something that is harmful to them. And I'm going to do that.
I'm talking with Eric Adams, the Democratic nominee and very likely next mayor of New York City. We'll continue in a moment.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
You've got a very complicated issue to face in essentially in your wheelhouse of on crime and police reform. How do you sell the police and their unions on the idea of reform? And how do you speak to the left, which is a very big constituency in this city, about the notion of defunding the police? This is not a cartoon issue. Nobody is saying strip the police of all resources on the one hand. So how do you deal with a very complex situation in which a pandemic was probably largely responsible for a spike in certain crime statistics? It's very serious. But a lot of public opinion has changed, and you seem to be saying no to defund the police, to even reform of the police that is pretty profound. You seem to be saying, wait a minute, I'm not up for that.
No, I'm not. I dedicated my life to police reform. But what many people don't know, when I was 15 years old and the police assaulted me, they don't know that around that same time, I lost a good friend to gun violence. The crack wars were taking place. And so I was traumatized by police, and I was traumatized by the gang drug violence. And so I come in with this dual emotion that the prerequisite to prosperity is public safety and justice, and we could have both. And I'm going to reach out to my unions and I'm going to reach out, my law enforcement unions, that is, and I'm going to reach out to the credible messengers, crisis management teams, my clergy groups, and everyday New Yorkers, and I'm going to tell them, let's turn the page. We need each other. The streets of our city, those streets will be controlled by the good guys or bad guys, and right now the bad guys are winning, and it is harmful to police officers, and it's harmful to everyday people.
You say the bad guys are winning. I hear rhetoric like that sometimes on right-wing Twitter and Fox, and as if somehow uniformly the streets of New York have gone from placid to berserk. There's no doubt there's been spike in some crime statistics, without a doubt, and I don't underestimate that and the danger of that. But isn't that largely the result of the effect of the pandemic and all that has wrought? You want to bring back hugely controversial, now disbanded anti-crime unit of the New York Police Department. But that was notorious in its time for harassment and worse, wasn't it? Aren't you wary of bringing back Giuliani-era methods that led us to a bad place in this city?
No, I'm not. And first, let's look at anti-crime never went away. And Giuliani didn't bring anti-crime. Anti-crime plainclothes officers, they have been in place as long as policing has been in place. You know, they abused it. And abuse of a tool is the worst thing you can do. And that's the same thing with stop, question, and frisk. We went to stop and frisk. We took a tool and we said, instead of using it what you're supposed to use it for, if someone is, you believe someone's committed a crime, we use it as a quota system. That's what I fought against and testified against. We basically said, go into a community based on ethnicity and crime level and stop everyone you see. That's an abuse of a tool. Eric Adams is mayor. My police commissioner is going to know how to use tools the way they're supposed to be used legally and not abuse those tools. And so, no, we don't have a city that's back to 2,000 homicides a year. But perception is reality. If we continue to see three-year-olds shot in Times Square or Asian members of our city attacked, it's going to hurt tourism, a multi-billion dollar industry. No one is going to return here. We're going to lose our high income earners who are fleeing because they don't feel safe. Remember, only 65,000 people pay 51% of our income taxes. That allows us to have teachers, sanitation employees, police. We can't lose our high income earners. And so the perception of fear is hurting our economy.
So your fear is that wealthy people in New York City are going to run off to Palm Beach and wherever, and we're going to lose so much tax revenue that city services across the board are going to deteriorate.
I fear that, and I fear large corporations stating, I am not staying in this city, like they're saying to parts of San Francisco, when you see tent cities and you see a total disorder in San Francisco, large corporations are leaving the city. And what's happening at Washington Square Park? I was there the other day with my son. Someone was injecting themselves with heroin right inside the park. You can't run cities the way we're running this city. And I'm fearful that if we lose our corporations, our high income earners, we're not going to be able to employ middle class New Yorkers, that they're going to be able to enjoy the quality of life they deserve.
Mr. Adams, you know better than anyone that despite Brown versus the Board of Education and the many decades that followed, New York City still has a public school system that is astonishingly segregated. And the question is what to do about it.
That's a great question. We're a segregated city. You know, our schools, they are a reflection of how we're segregated as a city. We try to act like we're hip and cool and integrated. Like heck we are. Are you kidding me? We live in these pockets. And people, they talk about it, you know, let's all live together. But, you know, try to build affordable housing on someone's block. And they say, wait a minute, we don't want these people here. We need to stop it. You know.
But what are you prepared to do to change that when it comes to the school system? Do you think it shouldn't be changed?
No, it should be changed. You know, the quality of an education is not only being academically smart, but being emotionally intelligent. And our children must develop their full personhood. And part of that is understanding and appreciating diversity. That is our secret weapon. Number one, I am a believer we have to upzone in affluent communities. We have had it backwards for so long. We've upzoned in poor communities, move rich people in and displace poorer people. No, let's upzone in affluent communities, move poorer people in, and allow them to diversify the schools in the process, because now you live in that district. Allow them access to healthy food, access to good health care, where you could have a holistic approach. And then let's make sure we do what we did in Park Slope.
So you just got finished saying to me you're worried about the tiny proportion of rich people running out of New York City. If poor people start somehow, I don't know how they're going to do it, move into Fifth Avenue and Park Avenue, don't you think that's going to hasten the departure of people on Fifth Avenue to Palm Beach?
And no, I do not. When I speak to my affluent New Yorkers and sit down, engage real healthy conversations of having a real affordable housing program in their communities, no, we're not talking about shelters. We're not talking about building NYCHA on Park and 53rd Street. We're talking about mixed income, affordable units where people can come and desegregate their communities. And a lot of my affluent New Yorkers enjoy knowing that their children are growing up in a diverse, multicultural environment. And I think we give New Yorkers a bad, really marked by thinking they don't. I think it's possible. We have to diversify our schools. We're doing a disservice to our children.
So you live in Bed-Stuy, which is a big neighborhood in Brooklyn, for those who live out of town, as we say in New York. Bed-Stuy traditionally for decades has been a mainly black neighborhood in Brooklyn, big neighborhood, and it's increasingly gentrified. And how do you feel about that? How do you feel about the gentrification of your own neighborhood?
Well, first, I love diversity. And we need to really understand gentrification is not an ethnicity. It's a mindset. And when you come into a community, no matter what your ethnicity may be, and you don't talk to the people who are there, you don't patronize the stores, the shops, you basically attempt to displace a long-term good practices, that's gentrification. But if you come into a community with that old time feeling that you come with a cake, that you're now a new neighbor, if you engage in, if you're part of the school, if you involve, that's a wonderful thing. I want my son to know, I look at his friends and I see the different ethnic groups and how they engage with each other. That's an amazing, beautiful feeling. But the energy of coming into a community and believing that you are now taking over and you're going to use the police and other agencies as your tools to go after their long-term residents there and displace them, that's wrong. That can't happen, and we cannot allow it to happen.
One of the most complicated, perhaps the most complicated relationship you're going to have to negotiate as mayor, and this has always been the case in New York, is with the governor. Governors and mayors get along like cats and dogs. You know it, and I know it. The relationships have always been, at best, horrible. Horrible. De Blasio and Cuomo can barely say a civil word to each other. Now, as you well know, Governor Cuomo is being investigated for reports of sexual harassment. And you were not one of those who joined the call for Cuomo to resign. Why not?
Because it's a process. What's great about this amazing country we're in is something called due process. And particularly as a black man, History has so many examples of where people have just basically stated, we're going to skip over the due process part. We have an investigation taking place. The attorney general is extremely competent. Let her do her job. She did interview him, as well as the victims that stated they were victimized. Let's let the process take its course.
And did the accusations trouble you?
Yes, they did. They were extremely troubling. I believe that no one should be the victim of any over-aggressive or any intrusive actions. I was extremely troubled to hear them, but I do respect the process, and we need to allow the process to take its course.
Mr. Adams, a final question. Who's the best mayor this city has ever had?
That's a great question. I will have to mix up a few. I patterned myself after Dinkins, Bloomberg, and LaGuardia. a blue-collar guy, you know, just an everyday guy, blue-collar guy, nothing fancy. There's nothing fancy about me, you know.
Wait, you're not saying Michael Bloomberg is a blue-collar guy.
Bloomberg was a good, smart person that knew how to use data, but when you pattern yourself on the ground, I think that's the energy and spirit of a person, a hardworking New Yorker. The life I live is a life that New Yorkers are living right now, from being a dishwasher, going to school at night, paying my way through college, working hard, having a learning disability, overcoming that, being arrested, but going from saying, woe is me to why not me. That's what people picked up when I ran for mayor. They said, this is one of us. This is just an ordinary guy that wants to do something for ordinary people in this city.
Mr. Adams, thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care.
Eric Adams is the Democratic nominee for mayor of New York City, and he faces Republican Curtis Sliwa in the November general election. I'm David Remnick. Thanks for joining us. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kala Lea, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses,
Annabelle Bacon,
and Stephen Valentino.
And we had additional help from Harrison Keithline.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.